I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, we present a special program entitled Prison Injustice, Mass Incarceration, Police Reform, and People of Color, featuring Rabbi Jill Jacobs of Truah, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, Rabbi Michael Lizak of the Glide Center for Social Justice, and Dolores Canales of California Families to Abolish Solitary Confinement. And now, join USF Professor in Jewish Studies Aaron Hontapper on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces our speakers.
In the first book of the Bible, Genesis, the human species is described as starting off on what we might very generously describe as the wrong foot. Adam and Eve's two children, Cain v'Hevel, Cain and Abel, have some sort of problem, resulting in the older brother murdering the younger one. There are many interesting pieces of this narrative, but I'd like to touch on one in particular. After Cain carries out this heinous act, God asks Cain about his brother's whereabouts. Cain impudently replies, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Now, from the modern-day vantage point, the character in the story named God created the universe just a couple chapters prior. So given that God just created the world, God kind of already knows the answer to the question. Thus, where's your brother is rhetorical. As for Cain's response, "Am I my brother's keeper?" this is also rhetorically answered with a resounding yes, not then per se, but in and through the stories laid out through the rest of the Torah, the five books of Moses. The question of whether or not each of us is responsible to our fellow human is not a mere theoretical question. It plays out in each of our lives every day. The person living on a San Francisco street asking for food or money, who we all too often pretend not to notice. The stories we read in the daily newspaper or through Facebook about unjust things happening, whether at home or around the world, all of these instances of injustice are interconnected. All of these daily occurrences are undergirded by the idea of intersectionality, the notion that all forms of oppression, all forms of destruction are interrelated. Judging a sister by the color of her skin is akin to judging a brother by his sexual orientation. Mistreating a woman because of her ethnicity is akin to mistreating a brother because of his nationality. Intersectionality, however, is not just about how all forms of justice and injustice are interrelated, how the structures of oppression of one group are linked to the oppression of another. It's also, for me at least, about how the only way to move things forward is to consider one another as integral pieces of the puzzle. Whether a student or professor, activist, organizer, 20-something or 80-something, all of us have a role to play in taking responsibility for improving our world, for working to transform the what is into the what can be. Our three guests this evening, in many ways, embody that notion of how can I better the world. It's my pleasure to introduce to you tonight, first and foremost, Rabbi Jill Jacobs, who will be leading our 8th annual social justice lecture. Jill is one of the most important voices in the Jewish American communities today. As executive director of Truah, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, Rabbi Jacobs is at the vanguard of the Jewish human rights movement, mobilizing 1,800 rabbis and cantors, as well as tens of thousands of American Jews to protect human rights in North America, Israel, and the occupied Palestinian territories. Widely regarded as a leading voice on Jewish social justice, she's the author of Where Justice Dwells, There Shall Be No Needy, and has been named three times to the Forward's list of 50 influential American Jews and to Newsweek's list of 50 most influential rabbis in America every year since 2009. Rabbi Jacobs will be joined today by Rabbi Michael Lizak, co-chair of the board of directors of Truah, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. After serving as rabbi at San Rafael's congregation Rodef Shalom for 14 years, this past year he began a new position as a rabbi in the Center for Social Justice at Glide. As many know, Glide Memorial United Methodist Church and the affiliated Glide Foundation are one of the most important and active social justice communities in the entire city of San Francisco, renowned for offering daily free meals to those in need, running a women's center for survivors of domestic violence, and a range of countless other amazing social justice programs. Rabbi Lizak is part of the Glide team focusing on helping those local people in immediate need of food, shelter, and security. Our third guest this evening is Dolores Canales, a California activist at the forefront of the movement to reform the prison and jail systems. A few short years ago, Ms. Canales played a vital role in getting off the ground 6x9, a virtual reality experience of solitary confinement, an immersive audiovisual storytelling experience shown at notable venues such as Sundance and Tribeca. She also has particular insight into the evils of solitary confinement. In 1994, her son, John Martinez, was sentenced to prison. For most of the time since then, he has served his sentence in solitary confinement. Twice a day, food is shoved through a slot in the door to his cell. Once a day, he's permitted to exercise alone in a cement yard the length of three cells with the roof partially open to the sky. Johnny is one of numerous incarcerated men who has participated in hunger strikes to bring attention to the horrific and subhuman experience of being put into confined isolation. Among other organizations, Ms. Canales is active with California Families to Abolish Solitary Confinement, which she co-founded. She's also the Director of Talent Development with the Bail Project, which is working to disrupt the unjust bail system, returning to the restorative assumption of innocence. Please join me in welcoming our three guests, Rabbi Jill Jacobs, Rabbi Michael Lizak, and Dolores Canales, to the JCC of San Francisco.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hontapper, for having us here. It's really wonderful to be here, and especially in the context of this amazing program that you've created in Judaism and Social Justice. My name is Rabbi Jill Jacobs. I'm the executive director of TRUA, which, as you heard, is an organization that mobilizes about 2,000 rabbis across the U.S. and Canada to work on human rights issues, both here in North America and also in Israel and the occupied territories. And we as an organization have been working on issues of incarceration for about 5 or 6 years, with a particular focus on solitary confinement. And I want to start by telling a story about how that came to be. As an organization, we came to the issue of solitary confinement because we had been working on torture. We try to pick up issues that are fun to talk about over a light dinner conversation. So we started working on the issue of torture in 2004. This was before I came to the organization. I've been executive director since 2011. But right after Abu Ghraib, the organization picked up torture as its first U.S.-based human rights issue. We had just started in 2002, so this was really our first campaign to lift up a religious voice against torture together with other religious groups as part of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. And so we worked on the issue of state-sponsored torture for about 10 years until in 2014 the Senate torture report finally came out. Not perfect, there are a lot of issues with it, but we felt like that was a good time to close down that work and to start in on some other human rights work. Around that same time, a number of our partners in the community that had been working on torture started looking at issues of torture inside of U.S. prisons, particularly solitary confinement, because according to the international definition of torture, somebody who's in solitary confinement, keeping somebody in solitary confinement for more than 15 days constitutes torture, as do some other practices like shackling women, pregnant women during labor. So we started looking at that issue of torture, practices that count as torture inside of U.S. prisons, and we started having a conversation within the organization about whether we should take on solitary confinement as well as broader issues of incarceration. And at one particular board meeting, I don't think that Rabbi Lizak was on the board yet or at that meeting, but at one particular board meeting, about 5 or 6 years ago, Our board was talking about whether we could ever get the Jewish community to care about incarceration. And the feeling around the table was, no way. There is no way we're going to get Jews to care about incarceration. We're not affected by it as a community. We're not connected to it. There is absolutely no way that our community is going to get involved in this issue. Everybody would like to, but there's no way. And at a certain point during this meeting, this was our board, which at the time was all rabbis. That's no longer true. We've expanded. But at the time, it was a group of rabbis. And at some point, somebody said, well, how many of you have ever visited a congregant in prison? Every single hand went up. And then there was just shock in the room because the rabbis were turning to each other and saying, wait a second, I thought that was, you also had that experience, or I thought I was the only one. And there is such shame around incarceration within the Jewish community that even rabbis visiting congregants in prison, there's no shame around that. And yet each one thought that it was such a singular experience that they had never considered that, in fact, every rabbi in a particular room might have had that experience, that actually it is not as unusual an experience as one might think. And then the conversation shifted, and we started talking about all of the ways in which incarceration affects really every single one of us, whether it's because we have a family member or a friend or a family member of a friend who's in prison, whether it's because we are connected professionally to the criminal justice system, whether we are lawyers or judges, or we sit on a jury maybe once every few years as a volunteer, that there are many ways that we're connected to that system. And all of us, every single one of us in our society, is affected by the fact that we have a criminal justice system that actually doesn't do a particularly good job of keeping anybody safe, either people who are convicted of crimes or people who are affected by crimes. That actually we have a system that is putting people away without keeping any of us safer. So the conversation shifted, and we've been involved in issues of incarceration ever since. I just want to throw out a couple of statistics just to say why it was that we as an organization, and I believe that all of us should see why we as an organization saw the issue of criminal justice and incarceration as a crucial human rights issue, and why I think all of us as a society should look at this as one of the most important human rights issues in America today. The United States, as you might know, has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. 25% of incarcerated people in the world are in this country. When we think about the countries with the worst human rights records, we might think about China or Russia. We think about places that put people in prison for all sorts of political reasons, and yet the United States has by far the highest percentage in the world of people in prison, both per capita and in raw numbers. And of course we know that race plays a major role in who goes to prison. So there are a million statistics we could throw out, but I'll just throw out one, which is that drug use is pretty much the same among people of all sorts, of all races. And yet, when you look at who's in prison for drug use, 3 times as many black people are in prison for drug use as white people. It's not that the level of drug use is higher, but the police go out and they're looking in certain neighborhoods, in certain areas, for people who they can arrest for drug use. So incarceration is one of the major racial issues in our country, and it's one of the most important human rights issues in our country, and it's very much a hidden issue because people who are incarcerated are not living down the block from us. They're often put in very faraway places. I'm in New York, and some of the major prisons in New York are basically practically in Canada, right by the Canadian border. Here we're going to hear a lot more about Pelican Bay, which is, what, about 5 hours north of here. Until I heard about Pelican Bay, I didn't know that you could drive 5 hours north of San Francisco and still be in California, but I'm told that you can. I want to say just a word about what Judaism has to say about incarceration and about criminal justice. There are a few themes that come up in all of the Jewish legal conversations about criminal justice. One is that we have to preserve the dignity of the perpetrator or the accused perpetrator. Second, Judaism tries to create a system where we make sure that that people who are, that all of us are safe, that we want to protect any potential victims. The third principle is that when we look at conviction in Judaism, we try to get convictions beyond any doubt, especially for serious crimes. And prison is not a part of the classical Jewish criminal justice system as a punishment. And then the final principle that is crucial is that the role of any punishment is tshuva, or return to one's best self. The idea is not punishment for punishment's sake, but rather punishment because it is going to bring you back to who you were before. So I'll just say a word about the work that Truah has done over the last several years. We've been educating in Jewish communities across the country about all aspects of incarceration. We have this kind of massive book that we've put out that many rabbis and educators are using. It has some basic facts about incarceration and has a number of Jewish texts that can be used for teaching, as well as examples of what different Jewish communities are doing. So we have Jewish communities across the country who are teaching from this. We've made this a major theme of a human rights Shabbat that about 200 congregations do every year. And we've gotten involved in aspects and legislation around solitary confinement. I think you'll hear a lot more from Dolores in a moment about a particular court case to end a lot of the aspects of solitary confinement at the Pelican Bay Prison. In that case, we were involved in drafting an interfaith amicus brief that thankfully never had to be used because the case settled, but it was drafted. And then we've gotten involved in legislation in a few states. I'll just give one example. Last year in New Jersey, there was a bill that was presented, that was being voted on, that would have eliminated most forms of solitary confinement. So more than 15 days in solitary confinement, would have eliminated solitary confinement for certain vulnerable populations, juveniles, people with mental illness, women who are pregnant, elderly people. And we had rabbis across New Jersey getting their congregations involved in calling their elected representatives to support this bill. We had rabbis who were going to Trenton, to the state capitol, and testifying on behalf of this bill. We had rabbis who were speaking at interfaith events and press conferences and, as I said, getting their congregants involved. And the bill actually passed both houses of the legislature, was vetoed by the now former governor of New Jersey. And now we have, now that there's a new governor of New Jersey, we have Jewish communities across the state who are ready to step up and, God willing and people willing, get this bill passed, which will drastically reduce what is really torture in at least one state. And we're working in a number of states like that, and I really believe that the Jewish community, led by rabbis, but not only for rabbis, will be able to make a huge change in getting rid of at least this one little corner, one of the worst corners of incarceration in our country. So I want to just end by just sharing one of my favorite texts by one of my favorite rabbis. This is from Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, who was the Sephardic chief rabbi of Tel Aviv from 1973 until he died in 1998. And he writes a lot about incarceration and policing in extremely beautiful ways. And at the end of one of his tshuvot, one of his legal responses on incarceration, he says, "The foundation of the Holy Torah's perspective on human freedom and the social nature of the human being, created in the image of God, is that no other person has the right to confine the human spirit or his freedom of movement, or his freedom, which are holy of holies among all creations in the image of God. And in each generation, we must devise appropriate punishments for criminals that are consistent with the Torah's outlook and with the conditions of life." That is, whatever kind of criminal justice system we create, we need to remember that nobody has the right to confine the human spirit, and that everybody has the, I'm summarizing, or just paraphrasing what he says right now, but that nobody has the right to confine the human spirit, and also that whatever we do has to maintain the dignity of every single person who is created in the image of God.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
You're listening to a special program entitled Prison Injustice, Mass Incarceration, Police Reform, and People of Color, featuring Rabbi Jill Jacobs of Truah, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, Rabbi Michael Lizak of the Glide Center for Social Justice, and Dolores Canales of California Families to Abolish Solitary Confinement, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Good evening. I'm Michael Lizak. I currently work at Glide, which I'll tell you about in a few minutes. For 14 amazing years, I was a congregational rabbi at Rodef Shalom in San Rafael, a profoundly holy place. I think some of you are here tonight from Rodef. Welcome. Love you guys. About 5 years ago, while I was on sabbatical, I was taking the ferry from the Larkspur Terminal into San Francisco, and in my hands I had a book called The New Jim Crow, written by Michelle Alexander, which should rise to the top of your list if you're interested in the subject. And there I was reading it, taking the ferry right past San Quentin. The book talks about racism that is baked into the mass incarceration system, and there on that ride and on the ride back, I knew that soon I had to get myself inside San Quentin. Rabbi Jacobs talked about how often jails and prisons are often secluded far off in distant regions. I have often thought that San Quentin is a gift to the Bay Area as a reminder that if it wasn't there, we might think this was the world to come or the promised land, but there in the midst, right on the bay, and this amazing piece of real estate is one of a blot on our society. And so about a month later, I got myself in through a program called The Last Mile. And I taught about 50 men the text from Psalm 118, of which there's many famous lines. Two I'll give you tonight. I was sitting in a circle with them, many men who had committed murder, and were some of them were lifers, who said, it was really powerful to be studying this text. One of the lines in there is, "Min ha-metzar karatiya anani ba-merchavya." It said, out of the Meitzar, out of the narrow place, I called out to God, and God answered me from a place of vast expansiveness. So there's this movement in the psalm from being squeezed to being liberated. And there I was in this place of being squeezed in this beautiful Bay Area of ours. And it talked about this image of how do you go from here to here. Later on in the psalm, there's a line that says, "Evan ma'asu habonim haital rosh pina." Which translates to that stone that the builders discarded, that they thought was not good enough for the building, ultimately became the Rosh Pina. It's often translated as the cornerstone, but actually it's really the capstone of the building. And as I was teaching this line, a man behind me said, "Rabbi, when you talk about that stone that was thrown away, it sounds like what the psalmist was talking about is all of us in here. It feels like, you know, society thinks of us as disposable human beings." And I said, you know, we talked a lot about this process of teshuva. What does it mean to have a pathway to make amends and to become whole again? And so it was while I was teaching this group of 50 men through the last mile that I noticed the juxtaposition between the racial makeup of the men I was sitting with inside San Quentin as juxtaposed to the population outside Marin County. As of 2010, was about 80% white. And there in that room, and in general at San Quentin, the number's roughly 70 to 75% are men of color. So there I was, congregational rabbi to 1,100 families, and really thinking that this, somehow the Holy One dropped that book into my hands and summoned me to do a little teaching. I gave a sermon on Rosh Hashanah 4 or 5 years ago and built a weekly New Jim Crow working group. Where we unpacked issues of white privilege and thought deeply about what we might be able to do, how we might be able to use our power as a congregation of committed people committed to justice to bring a little bit of light into the criminal justice system. And bit by bit, we set out on different field trips and over time built pathways in so that still to this day, a group of congregants from Rodef Shalom go in monthly to sing with the Jewish group at San Quentin. This Passover will be the third Passover in a row where a group of amazing people have made Passover Seder for, it's up to 170 men at San Quentin. In the in the kitchen at Rodef Shalom, Chef Jeff Kirschbaum of the Mighty Mitzvah Kitchen made an untold number of matzah balls that and brisket that like descended from the heavens that then made its way into San Quentin. And for months afterwards, I would hear stories from men of like, you make sure to tell that Chef Jeff that that was the best meal I've had in 25 or 40 years. And so this idea of what would it mean to turn the dial on the new Jim Crow? What would it mean to bring more justice into the criminal justice system and more compassion? And we built relationships with the San Francisco County Jail and the jail in Vacaville, where we taught a group of people on the prison hospice there about Jewish rituals around death and dying, and taught them about Tahara and Shmira. Somewhere in the middle there was through Rabbi Jacobs and Trua that there was a gathering in New York City about what would a Jewish response be to mass incarceration. And there I met many people, including some people who ultimately introduced me to Dolores Canales. And I'll tell you, we're in the presence of one of the great souls I've ever met, who is doing incredibly righteous work. Dolores, she'll tell you more, but rents a bus 4 or 5 times a year and drives 50-plus people from Orange County all the way to Pelican Bay. It's about a 15-hour bus ride. 3-year-olds and 73-year-olds to visit their brothers and their uncles and their fathers. And when I learned about this and I looked at a map, I realized that San Rafael is at about the halfway spot. And so we offered to host Dolores. And so you got on the bus around midnight and your bus would pull into the parking lot around 7 a.m. And we'd been working diligently for the past days before to prepare a 5-star breakfast for folks who'd never met Jews before, mostly. And we saw people who had been broken by the system, who sometimes couldn't afford to fill their tank to get across town, let alone to drive a 14-hour drive. And you built this moving angelic ship that brought them to visit their families for an extended weekend. Mm-hmm. And at the end of your hour or 2-hour visit, we fed you. We would go into the sanctuary and we put Torahs into the hands of people, some people who did not speak English and had not met Jews before, and we would sing together. And invariably, there would be tears on all of our in all of our eyes of the relationships we had built. So I'm just so grateful that you're in my life and that you're on the stage, and I can't wait for you to share more holy stories. About 8-9 months ago, I left Rodef Shalom and started working at Glide Memorial Church, about a 2-hour drive from here and in some ways on a different planet, from walking from Pacific Heights to the Tenderloin every day is like visiting two different Americas. Glide is a church that, amongst many other things, I think of it as really a justice juggernaut that has over 50 programs, from feeding 2,200 meals a day to helping men unlearn violence, men who've hurt people to unlearn violence, and women who've been hurt, and a family, youth, and child care center. Second to last program I'll tell you about, we have an alternative to incarceration program called LEAD, Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, for low-level drug offenders and people who are prostituting themselves to buy drugs. Right now, SFPD, when they pick up someone who's got 10 grams of cocaine or heroin, will call up Glide and say, we're in an alley south of Market, and the Glide LEAD team gets in a van and meets that person there and surrounds them with love and compassion and sees, rather than a drug addict right there, they see the Tzelem Elohim, they see the image of God in that person and surround them with love. And I hear story after story about how the compassion with which people show up helps turn people's lives around and helps them feel loved for the first time maybe ever. And we connect them to programs at Glide. And I really think of Glide as this high-rise holy of holies. It's like a tshuva factory that helps people turn their lives around who've encountered more tzuras, who've been in the Meitzar, in the narrow place, maybe the narrow places than I've ever known. And we help connect them to places of hope. And I'm really proud of the work we did at Rodef Shalom on so many levels. This work that we're doing at Glide now, I think about what does it mean to turn the dial on the new Jim Crow? and to bring more compassion into the criminal justice system. It was about maybe a year ago that the JCC partnered with GLIDE to bring Brian Stevenson, I think one of the best prophets we have in America of this time, to talk about his work at the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. Brian's got 4 points that have become the Torah of my justice work. He says that we have to get proximate, we have to get close. I can't see any of you right now, I trust that you're there, but we have to get close and look one another in the eye. He said we have to have the courage to tell a new narrative, that the narratives we've been working with, of Jew and Christian, of black and white, of rich and poor, those don't work and they keep us apart. He said we have to tether ourselves to hope. We have to, he said, the opposite of hope is injustice. And the last thing he said is that we have to do uncomfortable things. And I can tell you, my first 6 months walking through the Tenderloin and hearing people scream out my door and seeing people inject drugs and, you know, dirty sidewalks is incredibly uncomfortable. And I can say to you, there's more meaning coming into my life than maybe ever has. So I extend an invitation from this stage up here to any of you who want to get close and tell a new narrative and try and do uncomfortable things, to come visit us at GLIDE. We need over 85 volunteers every day. In about 3 weeks, 80-plus people from GLIDE and my wife's congregation, The Kitchen, are making pilgrimage to the museum that Brian Stevenson is opening in Montgomery, Alabama. There's a memorial that they're building to the 4,400 known victims of lynching, and a museum that tells a story from slavery to mass incarceration and the through line that has not stopped. Brian Stevenson said, slavery didn't end in 1865, it just took on new forms. So we're making pilgrimage, a very difficult pilgrimage, and we raised money to bring 25 GLIDE staff members, many of whom couldn't have ever afforded to go themselves, and some who've never left the Tenderloin, to go with us. And we trust that this pilgrimage is going to change us and change GLIDE, and God willing, to change the city and to bring some of that light and holiness and a little bit of an American teshuva project back here to San Francisco.
Hi, thank you all for being here, and thank you very much for having me. This is an amazing panel, just amazing speakers, and I'm already inspired and encouraged just being here with Rabbi Jacobs and Rabbi Lizak. And so my name is Dolores Canales, and I'm co-founder of California Families Against Solitary Confinement. I got involved in the issue of solitary confinement when those that were incarcerated decided to go on a hunger strike, and they were going to start it on July 1st, 2011. And prior to the hunger strike, my son had been in solitary confinement for 10 years, and I didn't really give it too much of a second thought. I kept figuring like they were going to let him out someday because they had to figure it out. But then I started hearing stories of individuals that had been held in solitary confinement for 25 and 35 and 40 years, and I realized they had no intention of changing the system or ending the use of solitary confinement. So prior to the hunger strike, my son sent letters that were written to the governor, to Matthew Cates, and to like 200 organizations. And he said, you know, Mom, please make sure and get all these packages mailed out before the hunger strike. And I remember he announced that he and his fellow prisoners would be initiating, going on this hunger strike until their demands were met. And their demands were to, you know, end group punishment, because they were always getting punished as a group rather than individual accountability, and to end the use of solitary confinement indefinite, they called it. And California was using solitary confinement indefinitely on arbitrary purposes, which meant you could be held in solitary confinement for 20 and 30 years behind drawings, having possession of the book The Soledad Brothers, or something that they still use, other prisoners' statements against them, but those people remain unidentified. But what really got me about these demands was they were going on a hunger strike, and one of the demands was proper and nutritious diet. That was one of their 5 core demands that they were willing to die for. And then another one of their demands was education and programming, because they had been confined in these cells for decades at a time with no programming. It is provided at that time if the families could pay for it. We thank God that I had friends that helped me pay for courses for my son. He studied in civil litigation, paralegal studies, numerous law courses that we were able to provide and writing courses, things like that. So my son did have that. But if somebody's sitting in there and doesn't have someone, you could just sit in that cell and languish until your mind takes over and drives you insane. So I immediately got involved because I also have experienced incarceration. And I spent over 20 years of my life in prison behind a drug addiction. I mean, once I stopped using drugs, I quit going to jail. So it was behind a drug addiction that, you know, I could have been given rehabilitation for or something like that. But I don't look at that as a waste. If anything, it made me realize, you know, what we do to human beings, confining human beings in cement and steel and cages, is what really got me involved in the movement of the hunger strikes and solitary confinement, because I realized, for one, that California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation was not going to meet demands. That's just not what they do. And that they might very well let them starve to death. And what I also realized, as you were speaking about, what I felt at the time was that God gave me the strength and inspired me to get involved in this issue, because the very character is that we befriend one another. You know, to be human is to have other people's existence around us. And when I saw that on the carton of eggs, many of you probably voted for Proposition 2 in the November 2008 ballot for the confinement of chickens. And if you read your carton of eggs and the certified humane standard for the chickens is you're being guaranteed that the chickens had comfortable resting places, proper and nutritious diet. I mean, they had the hunger strike demands, and that they had the ability to engage in natural behavior. And when I read that and when I found that, it just broke my heart as a mother, because I thought, you know, the ability to engage in natural behavior, but yet here we're holding human beings without access to sunlight, without even so much as being able to hold your loved one's hand. And I thought, my God, what are we doing? It really woke me up to even my own experience. I was, you know, I had spent time in prison and didn't really think too much of it. It was that learned behavior that that in other words, because I did use drugs and, you know, that I actually, you know, this was the right thing to do to me, to keep, you know, incarcerating me rather than, you know, seeking out. I deserved it. That's the word I was thinking of. And, you know, how this began, and I started meeting other family members, and they would tell me, my dad, you know, I haven't held my dad's hand since I was 5 years old, and here I'm speaking to a 25-year-old young lady, or meeting a mother that, you know, she's on her deathbed and for 20 years hasn't been able to hug her son. And as I started meeting these family members and hearing these stories, I realized that we needed to do something and we needed to continue to push through until something was done. And so we immediately got involved, you know, going to Sacramento, having protests at the state building and rallies, getting involved with other organizers and advocates, and also with National Religious Campaign Against Torture. And that is how I got involved with Rodolphe Shalom. We were on a conference call, a national conference call, because I started organizing family visits for the family members, because many they couldn't afford to see their loved one, or they couldn't make the long trip up to Pelican Bay from Southern California. And here you had family members that didn't even talk about having an incarcerated loved one. And when we first pulled up to Rodolphe Shalom, and we're getting off at 7 o'clock in the morning, and here's all this whole synagogue of people like running out to meet them and hugging them and greeting them and saying, come inside, there's food. So many family members just broke down crying. I remember that first bus trip so good. That's actually encouraged me to keep doing them even more, because the experience was so beautiful. And what the families kept saying was, they don't even know us. And they just love us so much. They, you know, they don't care that we have an incarcerated loved one. And that love that was pouring out, it was just so beautiful. And singing in Hebrew and you know, just the love there that has continued. And I think we've been doing this for 4 years now, taking the buses up and visiting. And Rabbi Lizak is no longer at Rodolphe. But Rodolphe has continued on with all the amazing people. We even have some that join us on the bus trips and that come and have befriended the families. And actually, they could do a bus trip without me. I don't even know what I would do, you know, without all their help.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program is Prison Injustice, Mass Incarceration, Police Reform, and People of Color, featuring Rabbi Jill Jacobs of Truah, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, Rabbi Michael Lizak of the Glide Center for Social Justice, and Dolores Canales of California Families to Abolish Solitary Confinement. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
When I first began, I didn't know what to do. I was a mom, and I had a son that announced he was going to starve to death. And I threw on an orange jumpsuit and got a bullhorn and started, you know, marching in the street and talking about what was going on. I started reaching out. I could have never have done this alone. I believe that solitary confinement breaks the heart of God. I believe that our system of mass incarceration breaks the heart of God. And I used to tell people that in the very beginning. They used to tell me, oh, things are never going to change. It's always been this way. And I'd say, no, I think they are because it's breaking God's heart. I believe it is, or I wouldn't be doing this. And a lot of people remember that, you know, when I first started, that I always used to say that because that's what I felt with all my heart. And through this work, though, you know, what has transpired in my own life and the opportunities that have become available, I was able to be a part of the documentary, The 13th. So when Rabbi Lizak mentions, you know, that the 13th Amendment, where slavery was abolished, except for if you're in jail or prison. So, you know, slavery does still exist through another name, and that's incarceration. And I was also able to be interviewed by Oprah Winfrey. And, it's on the 60 Minute website. But the reason that I'm mentioning these things is because I was a mom that was willing to get involved, and I did not know exactly what to even do in the beginning. But because of so many people that were willing to embrace the family members and that were willing to help and say, what could I do? You know, I could still remember the very first day that I met, at the time she was the director for the LA chapter of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture, Virginia Classic, at the State Senate, August 23rd, 2011, and she came up to me and she said, you know, NRCAT, which is National Religious Campaign Against Torture, wants to support the families. We are here for you. We are willing to do whatever you need. When I think it was the third hunger strike and hundreds of rabbis signed on that they were against the use of solitary confinement, they considered solitary confinement torture. Synagogues all over Southern California were having the family members come in and speak. And seeing that involvement, and not only that, though, that for the first time ever, so many family members were feeling like people were listening, like people cared, and that there was such a difference. There was such hope that rose up in the families because for so long, for so many decades, they held on to that shame, as Rabbi Jacobs was speaking of. They held on to that shame of having an incarcerated loved one. And so what the hunger strikes did for so many families was it strengthened and it encouraged us that if they were willing to starve to death, if they were willing to do what they were doing, who were we to keep quiet? Who were we to not do anything? And, you know, this work, as it continues and as mass incarceration continues, sometimes you grow weary and sometimes you think, like, am I going to make a difference? You know, and then we continue to organize and to get together and to have movements or to have symposiums and to continue to do the work. And just recently, I just want to share, a lot, because of Ashker versus Brown, Todd Ashker and Donnie Trexwell were both in Pelican Bay solitary confinement for decades, and they filed a lawsuit, and they had been filing it, and it was 3 years into the courts being approved, moving on, when Jules Lobel with the Center for Constitutional Rights stepped in and got other attorneys in the area, and they opened it up as a class action lawsuit. So through that class action lawsuit, the use of indefinite solitary confinement was actually abolished. CDC can no longer use this. And thousands of individuals were released from solitary confinement out into general population, where they now were having contact visits with their loved ones. They were being able to have educational programs and vocational training and various things, although that's still a struggle, too. That's something else we're still dealing with legally. We're trying to get more programming and more vocational training into the prisons. And then many of these individuals started going to board and getting denied a parole date because they said that they were socially inadaptable because they were in solitary confinement for so long. And so then we got discouraged with that, and now we formed a parole committee, and we have weekly calls, and we've went to Sacramento, and we felt like, you know, here they were held for decades arbitrarily, which CDC even admitted, and most recently on 60 Minutes, when Oprah Winfrey interviewed the Secretary of Corrections, Scott Kernan, he admitted their use of solitary confinement had been a big mistake. So then we started feeling a little bit discouraged with that and feeling like, okay, now we're forming another committee and that's another issue we're going to raise. And most recently, we had somebody parole that had been in solitary confinement for 37 years, had been in prison 40 years, and he found his peace and his strength authoring several books of poetry and art. And he's in the audience, Jack Morris. But when that happened, that kind of like sparked something in us again, like, okay, you know, we've had one parole, you know, we believe now they're going to come home. We believe, you know, just the different shifting and the changes that you're always organizing for, or believing in and not giving up hope, and, you know, the different things that you strive for, and everything that you always keep in faithful prayer, you know, believing that we've had this much change happen, more than that's happened in decades. And though you grow weary, you know, I think, since they both mentioned biblical scriptures, when I read this one part in the book of Micah, and God is saying to the people, my people, what have I done to you? How have I wearied you? Remember your journey. I think of, you know, how our prison system and the system of mass incarceration has just taken over, where human beings have become marketable commodities, and that's how many people make their living off of incarceration. And so you have this one part that continues to get incarcerated and the other part that's trying to make a living off of incarceration. And so I think of that, and I think, you know, that incarceration breaks the heart of God, because we were never meant to be a commodity. We were never meant to be somebody's ROI. And, you know, so I just am very grateful to be here tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I have a thousand questions I want to ask both of you, but I think that given the time, we should open it up to questions from the audience.
Great.
Yes, my name is Jack Morris, and I've known the Lord about 5 months. So I have to ask, is there a time period on which buses will no longer travel to help the families of incarcerated men and women?
When there's no more prisons.
I just have a question regarding, like, once the prisoners are released, I feel like there should be some reform or some form of rehabilitation that takes place after, because once they're released, they don't really have the same rights or anything. Like, it affects their job, it affects their ability to get a home, it affects their, like, day-to-day lives. So I just want to know, like, your take on that, or what are the steps going after?
Well,
yeah, I can start. That's a really important point. I think a lot of times when we think about incarceration, we think about people who are currently behind bars, but actually it's a much bigger system, because there's a little over 2 million people who are actually in prison, but there's close to 7 million people who are somehow in the system, which means they might be on parole or are somehow under the watch of the criminal justice system. And like you mentioned, often people don't have full rights. So if people have a felony conviction, they might not be able to live in public housing, which means they maybe can't go home to their family, or they maybe are, depending on the state, might not be able to get certain jobs or might not be able to vote. And I think we need to think about a whole-scale way to ensure that people, first of all, are kept out of prison, that we have lots and lots of options, like you both talked about, to make sure that as few people are in prison as possible, or maybe we create a system where nobody's in prison. And then certainly when people are out, that we want a way for them to be able to be out and to lead meaningful lives. So there are a lot of attempts to do that. One of the programs that I love in New York is a program that's based at John Jay College, which is part of the City University of New York, where the last, I think, 2 years of your sentence, you start college inside. You're inside of prison, but you're taking classes from John Jay College, and then when you get out, you automatically are then on campus finishing your degree at John Jay, and then so then you have a CUNY degree, and there's a lot of help placing you in great jobs. And so we need more and more ways to ensure that people who are coming out of prison have a way to contribute to the society and not end up back in prison because there's no other options.
Right. That's one of the reasons that I took the position I'm working now with the Bail Project, because oftentimes when you're sitting in jail, your pre-trial detention, if you can't bail out, you take the plea bargain just because, and then that starts building a record, and then that starts making it harder to get a job and everything else that somebody with a record faces, where we're finding that over 50% of cases that have the opportunity to be out on bail through the Bronx Freedom Fund, we found that they end up even getting dismissed. And so that's a big thing. You know, starting right where it starts, and that's with pretrial detention and restoring the presumption of innocence, because once you do have that record and once it does make it a lot more difficult. You know, there is a lot more reentry programs now, although definitely not enough. And there's not enough, as I was mentioning, programming within the facilities. I know some people have gotten involved with the Anti-Recidivism Coalition, founded by Scott Budnick, and that's exactly one of the things that they do, that they work on. They make sure that when you go through the Anti-Recidivism Coalition, that you are able to find employment and that you're ready for employment, you know, by getting to work on time and things like that. So there's different organizations that are organizing around that.
I know specifically at Glide there's a woman named Angela who works both with the Women's Center and the Walk-In Center, who's at the, I don't know the exact name of it, but the site where people, when they get out of jail in the city, and she meets them and tells them not just about services that Glide has to offer for food and shelter, but any kind of programs they need to connect them with. So I think we're all in alignment about beefing up the systems that that help surround people with compassion and get them back to life.
Yes.
Hi. California is one of the largest economies in the world, and we have so many foreign countries that you had mentioned are doing it so much better than the United States, even other states. Colorado, I think, outlawed solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. Texas is even doing it better just from a financial reason. They looked at the death penalty. Is there anywhere in California that's doing anything innovative or anything better? Are there any of the state prisons doing anything unique or... There's so much information out there. It's just so wasteful not to be taking advantage of this.
In California, I mean, I know of other states, Colorado, like you mentioned, Maine. There's a myth that it's the liberal states, the more progressive states, that would be the first to get rid of solitary confinement. And it's actually not true. It's Colorado, Mississippi, Maine. I'm not sure if I missed any. Those are the ones that I know. Mm-hmm. And some of it is financial, and some of it is that the states have learned that solitary confinement doesn't make anybody safer, not the prisoners certainly, and not the people who are working in the prisons. I spent some time, the person who was the commissioner of prisons in Maine then came to New York City, though he's now leaving for a lot of reasons, but I got to spend some time in various meetings with him talking about his experience in Maine and what he was trying to bring that same model to New York. And he said that when he first introduced the idea of getting rid of solitary in Maine, all of the correction officers were against it, because how do we control the prisoners if we can't put them in solitary? And he said, once they got rid of solitary, the corrections officers were never going back, because they realized that everybody was in a better position. But Dolores, you can talk more about the specifics of what's happening in California.
Well, because of the lawsuit, Ashker versus Brown, there was a settlement agreement reached with CDC. They didn't end up going to trial, and that is where thousands got out of solitary confinement. The numbers have been greatly reduced. And as I explained earlier, you know, you have families now that hadn't, you know, been able to touch their loved one in decades, and they're visiting, they're able to visit and everything. So California has made huge changes compared to the way that it used to be, although there's still some loopholes that they're still able to use it pending investigation. You could sit for, you know, a year or 2 years in administrative segregation, which is even worse than the security housing unit, which everyone calls SHU. And they still use certain things to put you back in solitary. So it's just like, you know, it's constant, although the numbers have been greatly reduced and, you know, from what it once was. So California has made a lot of changes. There was a bill passed as far as juveniles, as I mentioned earlier, that you cannot hold juveniles in California in solitary confinement. So there has been, although nothing as significant as Colorado or Maine. But in Colorado, you have Rick Ramish, who is the director of corrections for Colorado, that he insisted on change and totally revamped the prison system there. And I was recently on a panel with him in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and he said that he's worked every field of the system, from being a district attorney to a gang unit officer to a warden, a correctional officer. And he said throughout his entire employment history with corrections, he sees that none of it, not at any angle, does it work, but it's only created to produce mass incarceration the way that our system is right now, from every angle of it. So, you know, hearing him and listening to him speak, but yet seeing the changes that he did make in Colorado, makes me very hopeful, you know, that that it's going to continue to change. It has in states. We're also on a national committee, a national campaign, trying to help as many states as possible to have campaigns going in, you know, in their regions. But we have come a long way in California compared to where we were even just 5 years ago.
I think on that note, we are going to thank our panel for being here, and to USF and to Aaron. And I think we can all agree that they are doing holy work. So thank you all.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's program was Prison Injustice, Mass Incarceration, Police Reform, and People of Color, featuring Rabbi Jill Jacobs of Truah, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, Rabbi Michael Lizak of the Glide Center for Social Justice, and Dolores Canales of California Families to Abolish Solitary Confinement. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.